Good afternoon. We have before us today the third case, State v. Brent T. Novy, 11AP 407CR through 11AP 409CR. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Brent Novy, is Attorney Gerald Boyle. Mr. Boyle, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Gerald P. Boyle. I'm an attorney from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, representing the interests of Mr. Brent Novy. The two main issues before the court, I think, are very simplistic. But I'd like to address the second one before I go on to one about the disclosure and discovery. And the reason I want to do that is because I know of no law in the state of Wisconsin that would give us any guidance as to whether or not a juror sleeping or appearing to be sleeping during closing argument can possibly be reasons for reversal. That happened to me in a case some years ago, and we had a hearing on it. The judge ruled that people do not have to listen to closing argument. It's not testimonial. And it is not evidence, but it can be helpful. But other than affecting the lawyer's self-esteem, which it did in this case, the end result was that the defendant was acquitted, so the issue never had to be raised later. In this case, there's no question but that one of the jurors was sleeping or appeared to be sleeping, and the court ruled basically that it's not testimonial, and therefore would not be grounds for dismissal. Only in Colorado, I think, do we find a different answer than we do in all the other states, and certainly in Wisconsin we don't. Now, I don't very well can't say that it's clear in the jury instructions that the jurors are told that closing arguments and opening statements are not testimony or evidence, but they can use it as they wish to assist them in what the testimony might or might show. So I think it would be fruitless and a waste of your time for me to argue anything more about that, since it is a case of first impression. And in my opinion, I cannot argue the fact that it is non-testimonial. It is non-testimonial. And whether or not this court feels that it wants to send out a signal to jurors that they have to stay awake during all parts, I think that the court would be correct if they ruled that it's not testimonial and therefore not grounds for renewal. But that decision obviously is before the court. I would have withdrawn the argument myself had it not been for the fact that it's a case of first impression, and I don't feel that I'm properly in a position to make that decision.
Counselor, as I read the arguments and the materials provided, I thought that the trial court made a finding that she didn't see that there was any juror sleeping.
Judge, I read that, and that certainly is true, but I don't think the judge in his decision made that the issue. I think he made the issue that you just don't have to have a juror listen to closing argument if they choose not to listen. I mean, let's face facts, jurors may be thinking about the Green Bay Packer game during the entire closing argument. We wouldn't know that, but it wouldn't really make any difference because what's important is that they listen to all the testimony and then made their decision on the testimony. Does that answer your Honor's?
Well, you know, I thought it was a finding, and we adhere to the findings of the circuit court unless they're clearly erroneous. And I thought the judge was asked about this. It was brought to her attention, and she said she didn't see any jurors sleeping. And I thought she said, and I watched the jury quite closely. So if it's a finding of fact, that's a different kind of an issue than if it's a question of law about whether we want to do something with a juror who was sleeping. You got to get over the first step, was there a juror sleeping, before you can get to the second step, don't you?
I understand that, Judge. I'm not going to disagree with that. Thank you. Now, the first issue is I think, a lot more simplistic than what we all wrote to the court. There is no question that the state had in its discovery an officer or two who would testify that indeed the fingerprints of Mr. Novy was on a phone receiver, and they were planning on introducing that as part of their case on count number 7. When it got to that point, in opening statement, that was alluded to by the state, that they had this evidence. The problem was, as we all know from reading the briefs, that none of that information was turned over to the defense. 971-27-7MA says that the court shall exclude any evidence not listed or evidence not presented for inspection or copying required by this section unless good cause is shown for failure to comply. The rest of it doesn't really matter to this case. The court found that the state was in violation of that subsection and excluded the officers and excluded the findings of fingerprint analysis. The state proceeded, and at the end of their case, upon motion by the defense that count 7 be dismissed, and without any real objection by the state, that count was dismissed because 971-23-7MA was violated. It would seem to me, and I don't know that we put that in the brief, but it seems to me at that moment in time, that count is dismissed, jeopardy has attached, and now we proceed to the defense. While the defendant is on a witness stand, he is asked the question by the state, did you or did you not make a phone call from that payphone? His answer was, I did not. The state says, in effect, that magically, the mistake that was made that caused the state to lose the right to introduce that testimony suddenly was cleansed. So that even though the statute says a shall, we now remove the shall and it becomes, but it can be used in rebuttal if the defendant takes the witness stand and testifies differently. Now suddenly the failure to disclose is cured. And the defendant has to accept that, and there is no way of stopping him from doing that. Now, I don't know how clearly I can put it other than that. We say that's faulty reasoning. It's either not admissible or it may be admissible. And we don't have anything in the statute that says it may be admissible. We have case law that the state has used to try and justify their not giving over the information they were required to do, but when they did not do that, and later the defendant testifies, suddenly what they did not do became something they can do. It's that simple. We say that if a court says, and we can take in Miranda, we can take in Harris, we can take in all the other rationalization we wish, but this case says that they cannot use that testimony. But because they made a mistake and the defendant testified, now they can use it. And I would
can I interrupt you for a minute?
Sure, Judge Crooks.
Doesn't it make a difference here that the charge that gets dismissed is a bail jumping charge?
Yes, sir.
But that the time frame for the second stalking charge includes the time frame when allegedly this call was made. And We went back and looked at the record, and there actually, as I'm sure you're aware, there actually is a discussion between the judge and the two attorneys about this. And when the judge gets done saying that it's part of the time period in the second stalking, he agrees with the prosecution. Then the defense attorney says, okay, that strikes me as a forfeiture or a waiver of the objection. How do you handle that? What do you think about that argument?
I was troubled by it. I was troubled by it because I see in this record with all these charges and the theories, etc., that one might claim it's a non-issue. Counsel said it was harmless error. I don't think it is. I mean, it is. This court must be cognizant of what goes on at trials. And we never try a case with it being a chess match. I am confident this prosecutor figured a way after they realized they had messed up, when they realized that they couldn't get it in the case in chief, when they realized they had to agree to a dismissal, was confident that if the defendant testified, they would be able to accomplish what they weren't able to accomplish in direct testimony. And I just don't think that's fair. If I'm a lawyer sitting in a courtroom and a judge says to me, this testimony is excluded, I have to believe that it's excluded. This court said it's excluded, and then when they threw the case out, the question was asked, well, how about in rebuttal? And he said, I don't know yet. Well, I don't think that's a fair way to try a case. He should have said yay or nay. And if he said yay, then the defense lawyer would have had an opportunity to then raise another question of, Judge, I want to take you up on this adjournment to have this checked out to see if I have any defense as to the claim that that fingerprint analysis does in any way enhance the state's case or help me in my defense. So I understand the court's question. It's very relevant. But I just don't think that in and of itself should change our argument that when the judge said it's not admissible, that means it's not admissible, rather than try and find a way around it. Now, the state never had to bring that matter up. They could have kept that. They didn't have to list rebuttal witnesses. They didn't have to do anything. But if they fell into the trap of getting on the witness stand and saying something that opened up the door for rebuttal witnesses, it might be completely a different case. The fact of the matter is the case was dismissed. Judge in the appellate court in the dissent, Judge Riley, said it's irrelevant, it shouldn't have been allowed in, and that's our position.
Counsel, the evidence was turned over, yes? This person just wasn't named as an expert witness.
That, and also it was only turned over by, if it's there, go down to the bureau and find it, and which is a little different, really.
Okay.
And he did that, and he didn't find it. So if a prosecutor tells me that there's evidence and it's at the bureau, go down and take a look for it, and I go down and I take a look for it and it isn't there, I think I've done my due diligence and I don't have to really do anything more. I don't think I'm required to go back to them and say, well, I can't find it. It's their job.
Was the Court of Appeals wrong when it said the state had disclosed the name of the officer who conducted the fingerprint analysis and the defense had received a copy of his report? The state had not identified Thorne as an expert witness or attached a copy of the fingerprint evidence to the report.
Right.
Okay, so you're saying they had the report but not the actual fingerprint
evidence. Indeed. I don't know if they, I got to tell you, we weren't the trial lawyers or even the appellate lawyers, Judge, so I don't want to say something where I might be caused misleading. I don't know if they got a written statement of the fingerprint analysis in writing.
walk me down this path for a little while. When you have a Miranda violation.
Yes, ma'am.
But the statement is still deemed to be voluntary.
Yes, ma'am.
It retains its trustworthiness in the law, and so it can be introduced as rebuttal evidence,
right,
or impeachment evidence.
And I thought of that long and long, how you distinguish them.
Versus involuntary, right? Because if it's ruled to be involuntary, it's just out. You can't put it in for rebuttal. And what I sort of hear you saying is this should be more like involuntary.
Exactly, Judge.
Tell me why.
Well, the reason why is because if I read 971-7MA, it said it shall exclude any witness not listed in evidence, not presented for inspection or copy of criminal court, unless good cause is shown for failure to comply. I don't think those words are in Miranda. I think in Miranda, if it's shown that it was involuntary, there's no exclusion to that. It's involuntary. It can never be ever used. And I think in this case, with the word shall exclude, it means the same thing as in the Harris case, where it can't be introduced because it is totally excluded. That's my point.
Well, the Harris case cites Walder.
Yes, ma'am.
And Walder, according to the Harris case, says the court in Walder permitted physical evidence, and that's fingerprint too. Is that physical evidence?
Yes, ma'am.
And inadmissible in the case in chief, and was inadmissible here. It says Walder permitted physical evidence inadmissible in the case in chief to be used for impeachment purposes. And this is the quote. It's one thing to say that the government cannot make an affirmative use of evidence, and in that case it was unlawfully obtained. Here it was a violation of a discovery. It is quite another to say that the defendant can turn the illegal method by which the evidence in the government's possession was obtained to his own advantage and provide himself with a shield against contradiction of his untruths. Such an extension of the Weeks Doctrine would be a perversion of the Fourth Amendment. Now, this was not a Fourth Amendment violation. It was a discovery violation.
Right.
And the court had discretion. And the jury instructions, which is Jury Instruction Criminal 320, says, and this is not directly applicable here, but it deals with inadmissible statements in the case in chief and says you can introduce them in cross-examination, or you can introduce them not in the case in chief. But they are limited to impeachment only, not for substantive guilt purposes.
I don't know if the court's going to...
Pardon me?
I don't believe the court's going to accept my response. Well, I shouldn't say that. Maybe you will. But the shield that you mentioned was not one created by the defendant. The defendant had nothing to do with anything concerning the admission or non-admission of this testimony. The defendant was a victim of the state's violating a discovery statute that every defense lawyer knows about and needs to have, and then to see how it's going to fit into his playbook. When he is told by the judge that based upon what the state did, not what the defendant did, or had anything to do with, is precluded from being put into evidence. So the defendant then at that moment in time says, well, I'm faultless on this, and the system of justice has now protected me by saying it's not coming in, and then in rebuttal, the state brings it in and fabricates in a negative way, but rationalizes a theory to get around what clear directive of the court was this evidence is not admissible. I can say nothing better than that, Judge. I can't come up with a better reason than that.
So you view it as an absolute bar and that the rebuttal provisions have nothing to do with this?
Exactly as I would view the ruling in the Harris case as absolute if it's found to be involuntary. I don't see how we can separate the word involuntary than shall exclude. I think they're the same concept.
Well,
and I appreciate the state.
It's almost more like that's what I was asking you. The difference. I get why an involuntary statement is not admissible because it's deemed to be untrustworthy. That's the nub there. Whereas a Miranda violation doesn't, if it's still voluntary, it doesn't render the statement untrustworthy. It's just inadmissible.
And Judge, I agree with that. And that had to be addressed by the court, and that court made its finding that if it's involuntary, it doesn't come in.
Right.
We're asking this court to say, when this violation took place, they've had many months preparation for this very serious case, when this court said, it's out, I don't think it should come in. The statute doesn't even suggest that there's a way around it. Statute doesn't have any open-ended other than good cause is showing for failure to comply. Well, they would say that basically in all things. There's a good cause to be shown for failure to comply. That's not the issue here. They just plumb blew it. And they shouldn't be allowed later to correct that. I mean, we all make mistakes in the process of cases, but when you just out and out blow it by not doing something you're required to do by statute, you shouldn't be able later to correct it by saying, well, we'll bring it in and rebuttal when he takes the stand and we'll ask him if he ever used that phone. I just don't think it's fair.
Did you ask for a curative instruction?
We were not trial judge.
Pardon me?
We were not.
I
don't believe there was, Judge. I don't know for a fact. Sorry, but we were not trial counsel, nor were we the appellate counsel. We came in after the appeal decision. And with all due respect, I think his ship sunk when he got on the witness stand and said, in answer to the question, I didn't make that call. They were going to impeach him to the nth degree because they had the officer.
Well, he was asked, did he make the call to Julie? And his answer was no.
Correct.
Now, on summary rebuttal, he said, I made the call to somebody else.
He used the phone to call somebody in the Philippines.
So his response on cross about did he use the call to Julie may have been absolute
right.
True. And the fingerprints just shows he used the phone. It doesn't
right.
say who he called.
Correct, Judge.
So it's not quite a rebuttal on the testimony given.
With all due respect, Your Honor, anybody who looked at this case objectively would not have believed him when he said he called the Philippines, when the evidence probably showed a reasonable person would have said, I don't believe him. He called
mm-hmm.
Judith.
Mm-hmm.
The practical part of our business is that.
And without a curative instruction that it can't be used for guilt, but just credibility, that's probably what happened.
Yes, ma'am. I have nothing further to suggest other than what I have.
Are there any other questions of Attorney Boyle? Mr. Boyle, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Christine Remington, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Christine Remington, and I represent the state of Wisconsin.
Ms. Remington, would you raise the microphone or speak into it?
Is that better?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I represent the state of Wisconsin in this appeal. I will do the same as defense counsel did and start with the sleeping juror issue. There weren't many questions on it, but I did want to clear up something. I think he made the statement that it was obvious or something to that effect that the juror was sleeping or appeared to be sleeping in this case. To address Justice Rogensack's point, I do believe that the circuit court made a finding that the juror was not sleeping, but went that step further and said, even if the juror was sleeping, that I don't find any prejudice because this wasn't testimonial. On these facts, there was no, it's not an explicit finding, but I think it can definitely be interpreted as a finding of fact that the juror was not asleep. And I think, so I just wanted to clear up that. The state on the sleeping juror issue would like ask this court to affirm and conclude that there was no prejudice and that the defendant failed to meet his burden on that issue. Moving to the question of the rebuttal, the state asked this court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision and to decide that the circuit court properly exercised its discretion by admitting the fingerprint evidence in rebuttal. It is our position that the evidence was relevant, that it was trustworthy, and that it was in direct response to Mr. Noby's case. The state did have a duty to disclose the evidence. I think that there was some discussion about what the state did. The state did disclose the report from the expert and the name of the expert. It did not list the expert as an expert witness, but there's some discussion in the transcript that the circuit court did not find that was a violation of 971.23 because it's found that that statute does not require there's some discussion on that section does not require notice of an expert witness. It's more that was in a pretrial order by the court. What the court did find violated 971.23 was that the actual fingerprint cards, the physical evidence that the expert relied on, were not the defendant never saw them. They were made available, and through a complicated course of events, the defense attorney never actually saw these fingerprint cards. And therefore, that was why the circuit court excluded that evidence. It's the state's position that these are two separate things, that the rebuttal evidence is different than the discovery violation, and that it should be looked at whether this is legitimate rebuttal evidence and that the discovery violation is sort of irrelevant to the discovery or the rebuttal question because of the way 971.23 is drafted, saying it says explicitly that that some of the subsections do not apply to rebuttal witnesses or those called for impeachment purposes. We read 7M, the sanctions for failure to comply, not as the defense attorney reads it. The shall exclude does offer the caveat unless good cause is shown for failure to comply. And the state argues that under these facts, there was good cause for failure to comply. The state, this wasn't the situation on some of those cases where good cause isn't found, where the police had some evidence and they didn't turn it over in time to the defense or to the DA, and the DA didn't turn it over in time, and there was unfair surprise. The state thought that it provided this evidence to the defendant, and he found out on the day of trial after opening statements that it had not. So we think that under 7M, the circuit court, we would argue, had discretion whether it chose to exclude this evidence, even in the case in chief, and chose to exclude it, and we don't challenge that exercise of discretion. But because of that, I think it's even more makes our argument on the rebuttal more stronger because we can say that if it was an exercise of discretion and could have included it in the case in chief, then it could have also been included in rebuttal.
Counsel, aren't you asking us to really write something into 7M The statute says the court shall exclude any witness not listed or evidence not presented, etc., unless good cause is shown for failure to comply. Did the court make a finding that good cause was shown here for failure to comply?
The court did not make any sort of finding.
So then we're left with the court shall exclude any witness or evidence.
I don't believe that I'm asking you to read extra into 7M. I think 7M relates back to sub 1. And in sub 1, under many of the subsections, including D, that the witnesses have to be disclosed, there's already that exception that this paragraph does not apply to rebuttal witnesses or those called for impeachment only. So it's our position that reading sub 1 and sub 7M in conjunction do not make the shall exclude apply to the entire trial, that in rebuttal we could present evidence as long as it met the criteria for rebuttal evidence and that it was relevant, trustworthy, and in response to the defendant's case. To address a concern that Justice Ziegler had during the defense counsel's presentation as far as the involuntary versus voluntary question, I think that in those cases, the question of whether the involuntary statement or voluntary statement should be excluded all do turn on trustworthiness. And I think that in this case, there's never been an allegation that this evidence was not trustworthy. There's the only argument that the defense has ever raised was that the evidence was not disclosed. There was never an allegation that it was not trustworthy. And so that would be my response to your concern from earlier.
Ms. Remington, what is the state's position on the discussion that took place between the court, the prosecution, and defense counsel when the court indicated that this is part of the time period for the second stalking, and therefore it can come in, and defense counsel seems to agree with that. Do you find any significance to that?
I do find that to be significant. I think that he did make the objection up front, but seemed to concede that it was okay. And I think you're referring to that discussion prior to the defense case. I think that it was before the defendant had ever been called to the stand, and his attorney was trying to keep this evidence out. And there was another discussion after he was asked the question about whether the evidence could be brought in rebuttal. And I believe also then the attorney might have made some sort of other type of concession.
Well, Judge Riley, in his dissent at the Court of Appeals, seems to zero in on the bail jumping charge, which had been dismissed. And as I read him, seems to say that, therefore, this evidence wasn't relevant. The state seems to take the position, as did the court, that there is some relevancy to this testimony because of the fact that it's within the time period for the stalking charge, the second stalking charge. Does the state have anything to support that position taken by the court and the state at the trial level?
At the trial level, yes, there was that discussion. There was a discussion on day three where the DA said that she explicitly wanted to introduce the evidence because it was during the time period of the second stalking charge, and it does fall. The date that this call was alleged to have made did fall in the time period for that stalking charge, and it's the state's position that the behavior of the hang-up phone call fits the definition of stalking, and that the victim was definitely under, that it caused the victim duress and was part of the overall course of action throughout those months, caused her to fear for her safety.
So that would be your answer to the objection that such testimony was not relevant. Is that correct?
That would be, yes, that it was relevant to, I think Judge Riley in his dissent was only focused on the bail jumping charge, and if that charge was no longer in front of the jury and that was the only relevant charge, or that was the only charge it was relevant to, then his position was, the position in the Court of Appeals was that it was not relevant. But I think because it was relevant to both charges, both the bail jumping, which eventually was dismissed, and also to the stalking charge, that's why the state, that's the state's position as to why it was relevant and why it was admissible. I think as far as the victim testified that she received the hang-up phone call on this date and that she knew it was from the L&M meets, because she had already figured out the number of that payphone, and she testified that that payphone was close to the defendant's home. So when the defendant testified that he did not place that phone call from the L&M meets on that date at 8 p.m., it's the state's position that this fingerprint evidence directly does rebut it. It's not, it obviously, yes, the fingerprints evidence doesn't prove who called, but the time, given the time period, coupled with the victim's testimony that she received a call at that time on that date from that phone, and the fingerprints were found very soon after that she reported to the police that she made that call, that is also why the state believes that it directly rebuts something in Mr. Novy's case, that it was contradictory to that and undermining his credibility as to that answer to that question.
So it's introduced for limited purposes.
For limited purposes. And to address your question and during Mr. Boyle's presentation, that whether there was a curative instruction asked for, there was no curative instruction asked for in this case. And I think that it seemed that the defense attorney thought that by on sur rebuttal saying that the defense that he made this call but that it was to somewhere else was the approach the attorney took in mitigating the evidence. I think interestingly, like if the defense attorney had asked those questions on redirect, did you use that phone ever on that night? Did you make the call to and then if Mr. Novy had given those answers, then I'm not sure we'd be in a different posture as to whether the fingerprint evidence would be in rebuttal. Would be relevant because he would have just admitted to be making that call. But because he hadn't, because the victim had testified she'd received the call, and because the defendant had denied making the call, the fingerprint evidence for that purpose directly rebutted that testimony. One of the other points I would like to make is that the court did not exclude the evidence outright. It explicitly, when it said that the evidence would be excluded under 971.23, it explicitly left open the question of whether it would be allowed in rebuttal. And then again, before the defense case was called, the court addressed that the questions about the payphone call would be relevant to the stalking charge. And again, when the state sought to introduce the evidence, there's another long discussion where the court examined whether this evidence would be admissible. And I think those, all the circumstances throughout the case, the court showed that it exercised its discretion in deciding to admit this evidence and exercised a lot of discretion in that manner.
As a backup position, my understanding is you take the position that if this was error, it was harmless. Why do you believe that to be the case?
I believe that to be the case because of the evidence I detail in my brief, that the stalking charge that was presented as part of the time period, there were many other instances that throughout that time period that things that the defendant had done that would constitute stalking. I think it takes up a few pages of my brief, including, he would call her angry at work and found her phone numbers. out that she hadn't given him, and he would drive past her house. And I think there were two instances where he showed up at a coffee shop where she was, and this was at a point where there was a no-contact order in place. There was a neighbor who testified that they'd seen the defendant outside of her house during this time period. She received mail addressed to Julie Novy, which is not her last name and not a last name that she'd ever felt that she'd ever used. There was a lot of evidence presented as far as that stalking charge, and I think that given the volume of evidence presented, the testimony that he made the call, that and he denied making that phone call, that hang up phone call, and later the fingerprint evidence was introduced, it's the state's position that admission of evidence couldn't have resulted in the stalking charge, that he would have been convicted of that stalking charge regardless. I think one of the other concerns that's come up sort of on a tangent is that this information was brought up on cross-examination. And I think that Novy has argued that because the state asked the question, that it isn't proper rebuttal evidence. And I think that goes back to some of the Miranda, the statements in violation of Miranda, and that the defendant takes the stand and opens himself up to those sorts of questions, and that if the question by the state is objectionable, then that's a different question. But as long as the question by the state is allowed, then the state shouldn't be bound by what the state believed was a lie to the answer to that question, and that's why we believe that this was proper rebuttal evidence.
Are there any further questions of Ms. Remington?
All right.
Hearing none, unless you have anything further to say, Ms. Remington?
I was just glancing through my notes, and I believe that I've made most of my points, but I would again ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision and find that the Circuit Court properly exercised its discretion.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Boyle?
So, be short. I would like to address specific things that came up. Judge Justice Bradley asked the question, what good cause was shown to in any way obviate the statute, and there was none. No good cause was shown. Secondly, as Justice Crooks asked the question about harmless error, this court well knows that the most important thing in cases of these sorts is credibility. And as the state ended its case, it went right to the heart of the issue before the court, and Mr. Novy's answer certainly could not be considered, if it was inappropriate, to have been harmless. It was anything but harmless. It was a bomb, and I don't think the harmless error rule should be played here. Having had the great privilege of having been 50 years ago this time a law clerk for the great Horace Wilkie, one of the things I learned in the year I was here was that the Supreme Court really should try as best it can to frame its decisions to close off further appeals rather than utilize language that opens up appeals. If the court takes this case and says, you know what, Novy's lawyer was right. This was a breach of a very serious statute. How serious a statute is it that a court says Mr. Prosecutor, if you do this, you're precluded. And the prosecutor, for whatever way, whatever reason, as good a prosecutor as he can be, or she, who makes a mistake, should not allow any court, higher court, to rationalize language that's going to create this question over and over again. The court should decide whether the language is as it was. You're not able to do this if you don't do that. To later say, well, you're not able to do this if you don't do it, but if you get into rebuttal, maybe the rule then can be changed so that we can find a way of letting you do it. I think that's dangerous precedent. I feel bad. I was a prosecutor. I know I made mistakes. I'm a defense lawyer. I made a lot of mistakes. But when you make a mistake, you got to just say, you know what? I blew it, and it won't happen again. And we're sending out a message to every other prosecutor, don't make those kind of mistakes, folks, because you're going to be stopped from finding a way of correcting it during the course of a very serious trial. The sleeping incident, with all due respect, many a law professor saw me sleeping, but wasn't really sure if I was sleeping or not. I suggest to you the person talking to a person, not a judge on a bench looking at all 12, but that prosecutor looking at the jurors and all of a sudden sees one with his eyes closed and him nodding off, might be the better barometer of whether a guy's sleeping or not. But I don't know if it's that big of a problem. So thank you for your courtesy.
Thank you, Mr. Boyle.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Ms. Remington, for... criminal case involving an issue we haven't faced before, and of the use of inadmissible evidence as rebuttal evidence. So the court will take this as all the cases it takes under advisement. And that concludes our argument in 11-AP-407-CR-408-CR-409-CR, State versus Brent T. Novi. The court will meet in a closed conference in the conference room at 5 of 3. That's 2:55. The court has an oral argument scheduled for next week, I believe it is, and we'll handle the remaining arguments for October. The court is in recess until that time.